Greetings. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your co-chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Stanley Prusiner. Stanley Prusiner is a professor of neurology and biochemistry and director of the Institute for Neurodegenerative Diseases at UCSF. While at UCSF, Dr. Prusiner discovered an unprecedented class of pathogens that he named prions. Prions are infectious proteins that cause neurodegenerative diseases in animals and humans. Dr. Prusiner's contributions to scientific research have been internationally recognized with numerous prizes, including Richard Rosenberg Award, the Albert Lasker Award, and the Nobel Prize. Editor of 11 books and more than 500 research articles, Dr. Prusiner holds 50 issued and allowed United States patents, all of which are assigned to the University of California. Dr. Prusiner is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society, and is a foreign member of the Royal Society, London. Dr. Prusiner's presentation today is based on his most recent book, Madness and Memory, The Discovery of Prions, a New Biological Principle of Disease. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Stanley Prusiner.
Good. Great. It's a little more stable this way. Well, I'm delighted to be here. I must say that I didn't think 6 months ago when people asked me to come that I would be competing with the Giants. And so if we're behind now. It's 1-0, Royals. 2-0. 4-0, Royals. Oh, wow. Well, sounds like it's going to be hopeless. So maybe this is better to think about. So what I want to do is briefly introduce the topic, and then I'm going to use a few slides to take you through some of the most basic aspects of prion biology. I'm not going to try to make this difficult or hopelessly bogged down in science, but I really want to begin by saying that scientific investigation is a strange activity. First of all, it's unlike almost every other human activity in that there's a real truth that can be found. In politics, it's not clear that there's a truth. There's clearly a majority in a democracy that wins out, and in a tyrannical government, whoever's in charge and has the military behind him or her wins for the moment. But in science, there's a process by which you can get to a truth. Now, one of the things that plays a huge role in science is luck, because people can, and I'm kind of paraphrasing from the beginning of the book, about people spending a large amount of time, day after day, month after month, year after year, working on a topic. And with not so good luck, they don't discover very much. They produce a lot of manuscripts, they have a lot of grants, but they never make a great discovery. Now, there are a few people, and I would include myself in that, who get very lucky, and they stumble into something that they couldn't anticipate. And anybody who tells you that, oh, I figured it all out way in advance, well, it's probably not true, and then most of the time it wasn't a big discovery after all. It was just something derivative, because the big discoveries you can't will and you can't know in advance that they're going to happen. And prions are really a big discovery that turned out because of luck. Now, luck is such an important part of this. And in science, it's not like the Giants. I mean, if the Giants lose the World Series, well, there's next year, and the next year, and the next year. In science, there's only one discovery about topic X. There's no rediscovery. There's no rematch a year from now, or 2 years, or 4 years. It's not like the Olympics. So luck is hugely important, and I'm going to come back to that theme a little bit later. Now, when I first started working on this, my universe was Scrapie of sheep and goats and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease and Kuru of people. More recently, it's become clear that what a few people thought, that this would apply to a wider spectrum of diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, has come true. That this is very important, and in fact the causes of these diseases are prions, but they're different prions. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. Now I want to just give you a few words about what a prion is, and then I'll repeat this when we come into the slides. But I think instead of looking at the slides, just listen for a moment about what a prion is. A prion is a protein. It adopts a different shape, an alternative shape, and that shape becomes self-propagating. So more and more prions are made. In that sense, they mimic viruses, bacteria, and fungi. That's why we often call them infectious. Now, I got very lucky again with this book. So Sonny Evers, who's sitting here, together we went to England for a year and began writing the book. And she helped me immensely because she kept saying, "Stan, how did you feel? What did you think?" Scientists don't write like that. Scientists write in a very stilted way. This is what I found. All right, so I tried to put some of that in there. And then I got extremely lucky because a woman who I've never met, Abigail Zucker, who's a physician, also a book reviewer for the New York Times, a science reporter, reviewed the book. And she begins by saying, "Sweet revenge comes in many delectable forms, among them the receipt of accolades for work long scorned. And then to get to tell the whole story at length without a single interruption. Small wonder Stanley Prusner, renowned neurologist, writes with a cheerful bounce." I like that. Once disparaged, his scientific work is now hailed as visionary, and his memoir takes the reader on a leisurely and immensely readable victory lap from then to now. The beginning of the book is a bit of a memoir for the first couple of chapters. But after that, what I really tried to do was write a first-person history of the science. And the reason I did that is that I didn't think any journalists or group of scientific reporters was ever going to really get it quite right, because science is a very cerebral activity. You think and you think and you think, and if it's something really new, you're in a fog. And that fog clears occasionally, and you see a little way forward, and then you're stuck again. Well, that's exactly the story that I recount in this book, and I try to get it right. It's not easy to write a book like this because it begins in many different places and it stops in many different places. So there's no single timeline. There are a lot of things going on in parallel. Now, a few weeks after the book was published, I was at Cold Spring Harbor, and I gave a copy of the book to Jim Watson, and I wrote in the inscription, "I tried to write the second best book about a seminal scientific discovery." And in this review by Abigail Zucker, she writes, "But a parallel narrative turns out to be equally fascinating, perhaps not since Jim Watson's 1968 memoir, The Double Helix, has the down and dirty business of world-class science been given such an airing. Watson raised eyebrows with his gossipy account of the serious task of unraveling the genetic code, And he was working in genteel post-war Britain at the time, with experimental science still, at least in theory, a gentleman's game. That illusion is long gone. The stakes are considerably higher now, the competition fierce, the pace frantic. And Dr. Prusiner revisits quite a few of the battles that punctuated his long career. So a lot of that's in here. And I thought this was a special story to write in the sense that there were, along the way, many, many doubters, and particularly people in the press. So it gave it a kind of coherence that most science doesn't have, because this went for a long, long time, and this theme of doubt punctuates the entire book. So let me take you through this quick review, and then I'm happy to answer questions after that. So neurodegenerative diseases, as shown here, there's about 30 million people who have dementia on our planet, and there are about 5 million new cases per year, and about 80% of the people suffer from Alzheimer's disease. The biggest risk for Alzheimer's disease is age. So if you're 65 to 74, about 2% of people have the disease, but from 75 to 84, it goes up tenfold, and then over 85, it doubles again. These are bad odds when you get to be in your middle 80s. Now, there's mounting evidence that argues that prions cause most neurodegenerative diseases. So we talked about CJD and Scrapie and mad cow disease, but then there's Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and another disease that I'll talk about, MSA, multiple system atrophy. What's most important to understand is there's not a single drug that halts or slows one neurodegenerative disease. Now, my own entry into this field began with this man, Bill Hadlow, a veterinarian who's in his 90s. Still, his brain is working well. He lives in Montana. And in 1959, he wrote an article about scrapie of sheep, which he was studying, and kuru, which was being studied by Carlton Gajicek and Joe Gibbs in the highlands of New Guinea. And he said the two diseases were so similar pathologically that, like scrapie, he thought kuru could be transmitted to animals. And in fact, that's what happened. And Michael Alper, shown here, is still alive, and he's the one that harvested the brains from the dying patients. Here's Carlton Gajicek, who's now deceased, and Joe Gibbs. The two of them did the transmissions. Now, that was in 1966 and then 1968. And in 1966, this woman, Tigve Alper, a refugee from South Africa working in Britain, published a paper in which she reported the extraordinary resistance of the scrapie agent to inactivation by ultraviolet light and by x-rays. And fortunately, she didn't know what to do next. What she should have done next was to purify the scrapie agent, which means to separate it from all the cellular debris and then characterize it, because there were some alternative explanations for her work that made it seem trivial at times when people started to argue with her about it. And she was a fierce debater, but that didn't matter. And that really doesn't matter in science. So I'm fond of saying she left the problem to me. And that's where I began. And of course, we didn't know what the scrapie agent looked like. Oops, sorry. And here I'm just showing it as these little green squares with all the cellular debris. And we use the centrifuge to help us purify it away from a lot of the debris. Now, when I began this work, the work was almost impossible because people were using mice, and that was what Bill Hadlow used, and we had to use 60 mice for one assay point to determine how much infectivity was present in one sample. Well, within a few years, I was able to switch to hamsters following the lead of other investigators, and we accelerated the work by a factor of 100 using the same number of animals. So it meant in the late 1970s that in 1 year we could do more experiments that had been done in the history of the entire field, which up until the early 1960s had used sheep, and then eventually mice in the early 1960s. So developed a partial purification scheme, and we used nucleases that destroy nucleic acids, and then we used proteases, which was somewhat unique because we took advantage of the resistance to proteases that catalyze the cleavage of proteins. But what we came to was that every time we modified nucleic acids, we didn't diminish the infectivity. We didn't alter it. But every time we destroyed proteins, we ended up inactivating the scrapie agent. And I'm not going to go through this in any detail, but here we had all these different treatments, and you can see that three of them we lost infectivity. These were all things that did something to proteins, either unfolded them or cut them up. But if we focused on nucleic acids, the infectivity remained the same. And the same's true out here. Three more procedures that altered nucleic acids, now one that alters nucleic acid and protein. And when we reverse the modification of the protein, the infectivity came back. Well, as all that data accumulated, it became clear to me that we should get rid of this word virus, because people call the scrapie agent an atypical virus, or in fact, an unconventional virus or an unprecedented virus. And I thought it was time to stop calling it a virus, since there was no evidence for a nucleic acid, which encodes the progeny virus. So there's a big piece of RNA inside of the Ebola virus, and that encodes new Ebola viruses. And the same thing's true in a herpes virus, but it's a piece of DNA. Well, that's me with brown hair. I wasn't born an albino. And that's the scientific community reacting pretty negatively. And it became clear over the years that prions are composed of a host protein. So the protein is encoded in our genes, and it adopts an alternative conformation or shape, and this becomes self-propagating, so more and more is made. Now, people always ask me, who were these people? And I'll show you the people here. Those were the ones that didn't like all this. And then about 2 years after it became clear that these were not viruses, what we found were these rod-shaped structures up here in our most purified preparations. Now, at the time, I had a collaboration with a man named Robley Williams in Berkeley. And he was a retired professor of virology. Unfortunately, he didn't have a lot to do because he no longer was teaching classes, and those were the days of mandatory retirement in universities at 65, and he was such a bright, interesting man. And he kept saying to me, Stan, these do not look like viruses. If you've seen one polio virus, you've seen one Ebola virus, you've seen one tobacco mosaic virus, you've seen them all. Each one of these is a little different. And one day I'm paging through a book on the electron microscopy of proteins, and I see photographs that look like this. Well, these are amyloid fibers from the spleens of people who have a disease. And so then what we did was to stain with Congo red dye, as it's called, and do this polarization microscopy study where we see birefringence. What's green becomes gold, and what's gold then becomes green again as we rotate the sample through polarized light. Well, the next question was, are the amyloid plaques that people had seen using this dye in the brains of people dying of CJD and a related disease, GSS, are they positive for this protein that we had found? And once we made antibodies, Steve DeArmond did this staining, and you see the plaque is filled with the PRP protein in both of these diseases, but not out here in Alzheimer's disease. And people would say, aren't you upset? And I would say, no, Alzheimer's disease is a different disease. And if it stained there, I would have said this is all nonspecific. So specificity is really important in biology. And this was a great test. Now, yes, this is a prion out here, but it's a different protein. So people had seen all of this for years. And this wonderful slide from Winston Churchill in 1936, he's talking about Stanley Baldwin, who is the Prime Minister of England, and he says, men occasionally stumble across the truth, but most pick themselves up and hurry off as if nothing had happened. And that's what you don't want to do in science. Now, what we were in was the middle of a revolution. And this revolution is shown here in a cartoon where we had a new biological principle of infection and disease. And this was the beginning of a journey that seemed almost like heresy and ended up as orthodoxy later. Now, one major piece of the work was focused on the genetic origin of the protein. And at the end, I'm going to come back to this and mention it again, that if we had tried to embark on this problem 10 years earlier, we never would have been able to elucidate the genetic origin because we needed recombinant DNA technology. So once we discovered these fractions and enriched them and discovered PRP, then we could sequence PRP with the help of Lee Hood, who lives in Seattle now, and we could then make little probes, and with those probes, Charles Weissman was able to recover DNA clones. And those clones showed us that the protein was encoded in the genes of all of us. And George Carlson, who's over here, did genetic crosses between animals with short and long incubation times. And Dave Westaway found that the difference was in the PRP gene, and there were two amino acids. And they distinguished long incubation period mice from short incubation period mice. Well, then we moved to humans. And with humans, Karen Chow, who's shown here, who's now a professor at University of Minnesota, found that in people who were dying of GSS that I mentioned earlier and showed you a plaque, that these people had a mutation. So it was a substitution of the leucine for a proline at position 102. And shortly after that, we found another mutation. This is in Libyan Jews living in Israel, in these large families with CJD, and there's a lysine for a glutamic acid at residue 200. Now, independently, these two men, Elio Lugarese, a neurologist in Bologna, and Pierluigi Gambetti, they had gone to medical school together. Gambetti is a professor of neuropathology at Case Western Reserve. They showed that in a disease of Italian families, that they have what's called fatal familial insomnia. And they have another mutation where an asparagine is substituted for an aspartic acid. Well, all of this came together except one piece that took another 20 years to unravel. Don't ask me why I was so slow in thinking about this and why nobody else thought about it. So, and that is that in these diseases, it's older people who are getting the disease, yet they have the mutation from conception. So why is it that it takes so long? What's holding this all back? Well, all late onset diseases, so diseases in older people that have that are inherited, so these are familial diseases, they must have a second event, something that triggers the disease to be manifest at age 50 or 60 or 70. And this kept staring me in the face, but I never thought about it long enough to realize that the solution was right there. It was a prion had to be formed. So yes, the mutant protein's being made, it's being turned over, it's not turning into a prion for decades. And finally, when it turns into a prion, you get the disease. And I'm just gonna skip that slide, but I'm gonna come to this because this is kind of fun. And what's fun about this is that when I got a call in the middle of the night from the Nobel Prize Committee, and they said, we're going to give you the Nobel Prize. And I said, oh, that's really good. I like that. And the guy said to me, Niels Ringerts was his name, and I had met him 6 months earlier. And he said, do you remember me? And I said, oh, yeah, we had dinner together in this restaurant in Stockholm. And he said, that's right. Now, what I should have done was I should have said to him, yes, I remember you, but I want you to tell me where we know each other from so that I don't think this is a prank call. Because once I got off the phone with him, I waited several hours And finally, this was verified because I've had friends who got called by reporters and they were told that they won a Nobel Prize and they hadn't. I mean, it's a terrible prank. All right, so then what he says to me is he says, we're gonna use the following citation. Is this okay with you? And he said, prions, a new biological principle in infection. And it flashed through my mind that it really should be disease, because disease is a more accurate portrayal of all of this, not infection. But I got cold feet because I thought, what if I tell him disease and he doesn't like it and they take it away and they give it to somebody else? So I recount all this in the book. Now, we used to think about these diseases with all these horrible names on the left. And now we're beginning to think about them in terms of the causative proteins that turn into prions, which are in this second column. So PRP for mad cow disease and scrapie and chronic wasting disease, KRU, CJD. In Alzheimer's disease, there are two proteins, A beta and tau, that turn into prions. In Parkinson's and what's called Lewy body dementia and MSA, multiple system atrophy, it's synuclein. And here you see the collections of these proteins. This is the amyloid plaque of Alzheimer's filled with a beta protein. Here's the tangle of Alzheimer's disease filled with tau. So that's a neuron filled with tau in fibers. This is the halo of a Lewy body in Parkinson's disease that's composed of synuclein. And this is an inclusion inside of a nucleus in Huntington's disease. Now, this is a cartoon by Steve DeArmond in which he shows the spread of Alzheimer's disease that has been tracked by a man named Heiko Brock in Germany with thousands of brains from people dying of Alzheimer's disease at different stages. And the disease begins here on the side, the entorhinal cortex, and it spreads rostrally and caudally. And prions explain why Alzheimer's disease is a progressive disease. It's unlike stroke, where you have a stroke, the lesion is fixed, and it doesn't change. Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, these diseases progress. They get worse and worse and worse, and they involve more structures of the brain. Furthermore, prions explain how a single disease process can be infectious, inherited, sporadic, and even post-traumatic. We'll come to that. And I've already talked about the late onset nature. Now, this is a weird quirk of science, where in the 1970s, Carlton Gajicek and Joe Gibbs took 52 cases of Alzheimer's disease and inoculated chimpanzees and monkeys. But none got sick except for two where they thought the sample was familial Alzheimer's disease. But in fact, it turned out to be CJD, and it was a mistake. The paradigm was right, but the assays were wrong. And then came along these amyloid fibers that I showed you before, and then in the 1990s, using marmosets, Rosalind Ridley and Harry Baker in Cambridge, England, showed that in fact, sporadic Alzheimer's disease, familial Alzheimer's disease, and even Down syndrome, when people are 40 and they have Down syndrome, they develop an Alzheimer's disease-like condition, that they all transmit to brains in 16 out of 18 marmosets. Well, the modern era of this was ushered in by Matthias Eucher working in Germany in collaboration with Larry Walker at Emory University, where they were able to hasten amyloid plaque formation in genetically engineered mice. And they could even inoculate not only in the head, but they could even inoculate into the belly of the animals. And a few years, it took us a long time to develop mice where we could read this out by looking at light emission out of the brain called luminescence. And we were able to reproduce their experiments. And then others inoculated brain into genetically engineered mice and rats and showed they could hasten the process with the inoculated Alzheimer's brain. And then what we were able to do was what I consider the most important of these experiments was to make synthetic peptides. Now, what does that mean? That means to be able to make a piece of a protein, which is what A beta is, it's cut from a larger protein, and do this chemically, and they add one amino acid, one building block after another. So we did that, and then we were able to turn these into prions. And I just show you this experiment a little bit over here. If we take A-beta, which contains 42 amino acids, it's over here on the right, and they're these little short fibrils. And if we add some detergent that's found in Tide called SDS, or sodium dodecyl sulfate, we have these long fibers, and they're the same as the fibers if we start with 40 amino acids in the absence or the presence of SDS. Now I'm going to show you what happens pathologically. What happens if we use A-beta 42 and we inject it into animals 150 days later, so 5 months later, we see that the plaques are all green in here. They're made up of only A-beta 42. But if we use the inoculum of A-beta 42 made with SDS, the plaques are yellow because they have both A-beta 40 and 42. And if we inoculate with A-beta 40 in the absence or the presence of SDS after forming these fibers, it's all yellow plaques. So we are able now to distinguish two different strains of prions, make them synthetically, completely. There's no biology in this, so it's all chemistry. Well, there's a lot of other work, but the bottom line is that this larger protein APP, a piece is cut out by called A-beta, it turns into a prion, more and more of it's made, and that prion stimulates tau to become a prion, and eventually tangles are made here and plaques are made here. So this is really a double prion disease. Now tau is a fascinating protein because tau reacts and forms tangles with a huge list of diseases that I won't go through in any detail. But there's a very large number of diseases, and so tau was very confusing for a long time. Now there are pure tau diseases, and in those diseases, only the bottom line is happening, and tau is being stimulated to form a prion. Now, one way to stimulate this to happen is by trauma. Boxers, football players, and soldiers. And this also happens spontaneously in 50-year-old people. And the typical story of someone with a frontotemporal dementia at age 50 is someone who presents to a psychiatrist and is seen by the psychiatrist for years and years. And after 3 or 4 or 5 years, the patient is getting worse and worse and worse, and the psychiatrist says, well, maybe you don't have a psychiatric illness. Maybe, in fact, there's an underlying neurologic disease that's progressive. They go to a neurologist, and for years, the neurologist would diagnose them at age 50 as pre-senile dementia or early Alzheimer's disease. But in fact, they had a frontotemporal dementia, and now neurologists are being more sophisticated. They have a pure tau disease. Well, some of these people go on with the apathy and social withdrawal, become drug addicts and alcoholics, and others go on to commit suicide. So there are lots of examples of this in NFL football players. Now let me switch gears and tell you very quickly about what are called the synucleinopathies, which are Parkinson's disease, and Lewy bodies, and MSA. So in the first two, Parkinson's and Lewy body dementia, there are what are called Lewy bodies, and they're inside of neurons, and here's one that's darkly stained here. But in MSA, multiple system atrophy, you see the same staining, but it's now inside of the supporting cells of the brain called the glia. So there are only about 5,000 people in the United States with MSA, but Parkinson's disease, there are 1.5 million people alive in the United States with the disease. MSA is a much more aggressive disease with people dying in 5 to 10 years, whereas Parkinson's disease is 15 to 20. And we've now transmitted 11 out of 11 MSA cases from England and from Australia. So we know this is a very aggressive prion. Now, much like the picture of the brain I showed you earlier with the spread of Alzheimer's prions, the same thing is true of synuclein prions. But sometimes they come all the way from the gut and grow retrograde up the spinal cord into the brainstem, into what's called the midbrain, and then into the cortex. So it's the same principle. Now, I'm near the end, but I want to talk about therapies for a moment. And I just want to, obviously I like Winston Churchill. And this is one of his really greatest quotes. Now, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end. But it is perhaps the end of the beginning. This is about the victory of Montgomery over Rommel in 1942 in the Lord Mayor's office in London. But what are we trying to do? Well, what's really important is develop therapies that work. And as I told you, there's not one therapy that works at the moment. So you have to start and do thousands and thousands of assays, hundreds of thousands, winnow this down to hits, then into what are called leads, which are optimized hits, then into animal models, and eventually into humans. And I've got two slides about this, just showing you some of the instrumentation that we use. We photograph cells, and each little well, we have end up with 200 measurements, so we know exactly what's going on. It's very reliable. And as we take these hits and group them into families, I'll show you more of that in a moment, we then do a lot of chemical synthesis and go back into genetically engineered rats and mice. Now, what does this process look like graphically? So consider this a library, and we're looking at 500,000 compounds. And we use techniques like high content analysis, that's what HCA is, and that's what I showed you in the last slide. And then we take these compounds and we take the hits and we group them into chemical families or series. And so the colors, they're color-coded here. And even though they have different shapes and they're different compounds, they have a common theme, a common scaffold. And then we improve their potency. We improve their stability so they're not destroyed by the liver. We improve their penetration into the brain. We improve their distribution and retention in the brain, and then we study their efficacy as drugs. Now, I'm coming to the end, but I'm very fond of this slide because it's my life in one slide. And here's the precursor protein, wild type, as it's called, or normal sequence, that most of us have, 99.99%. And here's the wild type form, so of the prion. So one of two things happens to prions. Either they're degraded or they form these fibrils, which is a way of the cell in the brain detoxifying them, and you end up with plaques, tangles, or Lewy bodies. In the inherited forms of the disease, you're making the mutant precursor, but eventually the mutant prion is made, and it's either degraded or it ends up as fibers. This, as I've said, is an age-dependent process. And these are the sites that you can intervene in this process. And what I've told you about, we're focused here on number 2 and number 3. This is very hard to do over here. Now, there's a big question of how many people get Alzheimer's disease and how many people die of the disease. It's pretty clear that there are about 500,000 new cases a year in the United States of Alzheimer's disease, and there are between 5 and 6 million people with the disease, and the duration is typically 10 years. So you can imagine that 500,000 people have to die, otherwise we're not in a steady state. We're going up and up and up. And if you read the literature, even a year ago, and in fact probably even this year with the CDC, they'll tell you that there are 80,000 cases of Alzheimer's disease that die in the United States. But in fact, there are two papers that have been published this year that I stimulated to get published by epidemiologists showing that about 600,000 people have Alzheimer's disease, and they die of it each year, and it's going up and up and up. Now, this is, I think, the most important piece of data, because if you take 2,500 white females with 15 years of education and they're diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease at age 75, the ones that become demented, they live, this is life, this is the lifespan right here, they die much sooner than the non-demented ones. So you can see that there's a huge burden of disease due to dementia and a shortening of the lifespan. So instead of calling these people dying with Alzheimer's disease, I would argue they die of Alzheimer's disease. And why in the world is this important? It's important because the amount of money devoted to Alzheimer's disease research is this little red line down here. And you see it doesn't really grow over 35 years. It's about $500 million, and it's about a little over $500 million out in 2050, unless something dramatically changes. But the cost per year, about $200 billion now, keeps going up and up and up to $1.2 trillion out here. And the number of people in the U.S. keeps going up, albeit slowly, to about 15 million if we don't do something about it. Now I'm going to come back in my last slide, and then I'll be happy to take questions, and talk about this luck issue, specifically about prions. So prions could have turned out to be viruses, and they wouldn't have been nearly so interesting, no matter what kind of virus. Even if it was one that was made of kryptonite, it would not have been nearly as interesting as what turned out to be only a protein. Now, the protein PRP scrapie in the mad cow CJD scrapie set of diseases could have been 10 to 100 times less abundant. What would that have done? Well, I don't think we would have found it, because we couldn't have made our preparations big enough, because we couldn't have gotten enough money to kill enough hamsters to do this. So we would not have found the protein. Second thing is that if I were 10 years older and we'd started 10 years earlier and we'd done the same kinds of early experiments, which we could have done because the techniques were available, we would never have been able to study the genetic origin of the protein, because there was no recombinant DNA technology that was pioneered by Herb Boyer and Stan Cohn here in the Bay Area at UCSF and Stanford. So this was very lucky. Now, I used to call this the Obama factor. I used to talk about how when Hillary Clinton was running for president, Obama would come along, and he just showed up one day, and this was very unlucky for her. Well, now she's going to run again, and he's not a factor any longer, ironically. But in science, you can be working and working and working, and somebody can be off in another place. A few years ago, Sonny and I went to the Gobi Desert, to Dun Wong, and you could be a scientist in Dun Wong and figure this all out, write a paper about it, send it off to Nature, get it published, and I would have been scooped, and other people working on it who had been working on it for 20 years would have been scooped. And this happens. Doesn't happen very often, but it happens. And only 150 years ago could you prevent that. This is what Wallace did. He figured out evolution and the survival of the fittest, and he put a paper together and he sent it to Darwin. And Darwin got his friends to suppress the paper so he could finish writing Origin of the Species. And then he and Wallace debated for years and years and years. But in fact, today, if these guys lived 100 years later, Wallace would be said to be the guy who worked out evolution. He would have gotten all the kudos, but Darwin was very powerfully connected. All right, and then there needs to be a certain amount of limelight, and that BSE came along, and when I started this, there was no BSE. It hadn't been reported in cows. And then the cow disease is the only one that has been contagious for humans, so there's no evidence that scrapie spreads from sheep into people. There's no evidence that chronic wasting disease in deer and elk spreads into people, but there's good evidence that variant CJD comes from people eating tainted beef with BSE prions. So I'm going to close. I'm happy to answer questions, and then I'm happy to sign books. Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Prusner for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Madness and Memory, the Discovery of Prions, a New Biological Principle of Disease, with Dr. Stanley Prusiner. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. Please make sure that your questions are in fact questions and not statements. I will be passing on the microphone, and make sure to speak into the microphone as we are recording. Any questions?
Doctor, when was it changed from Jacob Creutzfeldt?
That's in the book. There's a whole story about that in the book.
Because I remember
this happened in 1968, because Joe Gibbs and Carlton Gajicek had just transmitted CJD, which was called Jacob Creutzfeldt disease, into apes and monkeys. And I asked Gibbs about this one day. I was sitting in his office, and I said, so why didn't you call it Jacob Creutzfeldt disease? Why did you start calling it Creutzfeldt-Jacob disease? And he looked at me, and he said, well, you know, when we transmitted it, we thought that was really the first important thing about this disease, even though it had been recognized from 1920, and we're talking about 1968 at that point. And he said, so I wanted to change the name. I wanted to call it Gibbs disease. He said, but I didn't think the scientific community would go for that. And in fact, the reason it was called Jacob Creutzfeldt disease is that Creutzfeldt described one patient who probably didn't have the disease, a woman who died of seizures and hypoxic brain damage. And Jacob described seven patients, probably four of them had the disease as we know it today. And many neuropathologists wanted the disease called Jacob's disease, but they settled on Jacob Creutzfeldt disease. So Gibbs flipped this around, and I said, so why did you do this? He said, because my name is Clarence Joseph. And I said, well, Joe, that means you need to write this up. And so he wrote it in an essay in a book that I eventually edited. And so that's how it all happened.
Next question.
Yes, hi, Dr. Prusiner. I have a two-part question. But first, I would just like to say thank you for your discovery. My mother was diagnosed with sporadic CJD last year, and we lost her, so thank you. She was a biologist, and she was aware enough to want to meet you. Unfortunately, she was just treated by Dr. Geshwin. So thank you from my mother. My two-part question is, number one, we know about familial and variant CJD. However, what more can we learn about sporadic? Because there's just a big question mark around that. And my second part of the question is in terms of the CDC recognizing, reporting, and perhaps a registry.
So the sporadic form of this was really hard to understand, and in fact, so was the familial form. And once it became clear this was not a virus, it was only a protein, then you could reconcile all of these. And the sporadic form represents a random process, and so is the inherited form, the familial form. But because of the mutation, you see this propagation 100% of the time as the patients get older. So yes, there is a productive infection that rages and eventually kills the person carrying the mutation. The productive infection is much rarer in a person who does not have a mutant prion protein, a mutant PRP. And there it's one in a million. And so that's because you're making prions all the time, but they're getting degraded. Now, why in older people? Because in older people, what's called the protein quality control mechanisms are less sharp, shall we say. They're less good. They function less well. And so occasionally, rarely, do enough prions accumulate that there is what I call a critical mass of them, and then they start to self-propagate in large. large numbers and spread through the brain. And what about a registry? Well, there is a registry for CJD patients. And this is a, CJD is a reportable disease, and it goes to the CDC, and then the brains go to Pierluigi Gambetti in Cleveland, and the final diagnosis is made there, and it's all recorded. Whether that's going to continue keeps going up in the air, up and down, because CDC would like to pull the plug and not sponsor this any longer because it really hasn't gotten much information.
Next question.
If prions are triggered by misfolded proteins, mm-hmm. what is it about the tau protein that leads to a disease? We have proteins in our feet and arms. What happens when they misfold?
Well, usually they're degraded and they don't accumulate. So many proteins misfold in what's called these protein quality control mechanisms, which involve chaperone proteins, are sufficient to get rid of these proteins. And when you don't get rid of them and they the prion spread, the prion form of tau spreads from one cell to the next, you get more and more tau prions being made. They polymerize into these fibers, and the fibers coalesce into tangles. Then this doesn't happen with a lot of proteins. Most proteins don't undergo this self-propagation. Many, many proteins misfold in the wrong way, but then they're either dormant or they're eventually degraded, and most are eventually degraded. But a few proteins fold into a particular shape. Maybe there are 10 versions of that shape. Those are strains of prions. And then they undergo this self-propagation. And the end result are these terrible diseases. Why is it the brain more than other organs? Brain cells don't divide. When you propagate prions in cultured cells and the cells are dividing, like the cells in your gut or in your skin, in your liver, in your kidneys, then the prion levels fall in half. And at the next division, they fall in half. And very often, they don't come back up to the same level. And so the prion infection, the prion disease doesn't take hold in these other organs. But in the brain, there is no cell division. And so when they accumulate to a high level in a neuron, the neuron tends to die or malfunction, and the prions travel down the axon and through the dendrites, and then through synapses into adjacent neurons.
Does the fact that prions are involved in Alzheimer's and dementia, as you just say, make it more likely or less likely that science will be able to find some way to prevent it?
I think it's going to be much more likely. The problem has been is that we haven't known where the upstream event is. What is the first event in Alzheimer's disease? So until it became pretty clear that that A-beta was folding into a prion, the first event in Alzheimer's disease was an unknown. So you would talk to people, and I would say to them, well, why does the disease progress? And they would say, well, there's just more A-beta around. And I would say, but that doesn't make any sense. The idea that you just simply accumulate A-beta, there's got to be something regulating this, something that is driving this to happen. And it's not just simply A beta. And they would say, oh, yes, it is. But I think now the evidence is very clear that A beta is changing its shape, that it can have many different shapes. I showed you a couple of shapes, one that produces the green plaques and one that produces the yellow plaques. And that altered shape is self-propagating. You make more and more and more of it. And you can initiate it from a synthetic peptide. So that first step is the conversion of normal A-beta into the prion form of A-beta that's now capable of self-propagation. And if you interrupt that and you interrupt the same for tau with a drug, then you can halt the whole process. And you don't have to get rid of every single prion. The cell gets rid of prions. It's a kinetic race. synthesis formation of new prions outstrips the clearance ability of the brain, you get the net effect is to accumulate prions. But if you can lower the synthetic rate below clearance or just equal to clearance, you will eventually clear out all the prions.
Any other questions?
I was wondering, can you explain the exact mechanism of the self-propagation? Does the prion like encapsulate a normal protein and then make it change shape? And also, is aluminum associated with Alzheimer's?
Okay, so there's no evidence that aluminum is associated with Alzheimer's disease. There are many papers, and about every 10 years there's another paper saying aluminum pots and pans are causing Alzheimer's disease or aluminum soft drink cans. But then this gets studied and restudied and it all goes away. And we don't know the precise mechanism. That's because we don't know the precise structures of the prions. So we're trying to do this kind of work where we get the three-dimensional structure. But because prions are very insoluble, meaning they precipitate out when you take them out of cells, and we don't know how to disperse them, we have not been able to study their structures very well. So we've gotten some information about this. And Jonathan Weissman, who's a colleague at UCSF, has done some beautiful work on prions from yeast, showing some of the gross structural properties. So we think chaperones are involved, and that's true for yeast prions. But just the details of this mechanism have eluded us so far.
We have time for only one last question. So who has the burning question? Okay.
If I understood one slide correctly, it said that 80% of dementias are Alzheimer's.
Right.
How do you distinguish what are non-Alzheimer's dementia, and how do you diagnose each respective type in living and dead?
So most of this 20% that are not Alzheimer's disease are vascular dementia. And most of those people have small strokes. But you need strokes on both sides of your brain to be demented. And those are the people that confuse the Alzheimer's world, because those are the people that respond to statins, and those are the people that respond to exercise. So when you look at all these epidemiologic statistics, there is this view that statins and exercise are really helpful in preventing dementia. But that's not to do with Alzheimer's disease. Now, there are about 15% of people who have Alzheimer's and a vascular dementia. So they make it even more confusing with this overlap. But the disease, the vascular dementia is very different, and you can see this on MRI scans. You can see these little small infarcts or strokes, but they're very small on both sides of the brain.
Well, thanks to Dr. Prusner for his comments here today. We also thank the audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.